Today, on the Nerd Outcast podcast, we talk about Final Fantasy VI. I'm your host, Chris Bashan, and we're going to be talking about the 1994 Super Nintendo masterpiece, Final Fantasy VI, which many people consider to be the best Final Fantasy game of all time, and some people consider to be the best role-playing game of all time. Is it these things? Is it really awesome? We'll examine all this and more. As is typical for my podcast, I've brought on a group of experts who feel they can speak with some authority about this given topic. I've got a couple here on the mic with me. My first expert has been on before, and his name is...
John Luce.
Welcome back, John.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited.
Yeah, you were on the Final Fantasy IV discussion.
Yes, and we actually talked a lot about Final Fantasy VI on that one, so...
We sure did. Which do you like better, IV or VI? I'm just kind of curious.
VI. Okay. I think I said in the first discussion that Final Fantasy IV felt like the set in Final Fantasy VI was the spike.
So now we're going to talk about the spike.
Yes.
And other volleyball terms.
Yes, I only talk in volleyball terms.
That's awesome. John, in case somebody's listening to you for the first time, what other types of games, maybe drifting away from Final Fantasy, do you really enjoy?
Huge role-playing game, fanatic. I'm playing Tales of Symphonia right now. I love open-world role-playing, like Elder Scrolls and The Witcher.
How is The Witcher? I've never played it.
I've only played The Witcher 2, and I just finished it, actually, and it's amazing and beautiful. It's very glitchy, and it has a very sudden third act that I was a little disappointed by.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any other favorite games, perhaps from the Super Nintendo era, that we should know about?
Oh, I always loved Illusion of Gaia. I always loved Secret of Mana, Tales of Evermore, Chrono Trigger, of course. Great.
And if you had to describe...
Tales of Evermore, Secret of Evermore.
Secret of Evermore.
I'm on the Tales series right now, so...
There's a lot of Tales games, so that's all right. Surprise question for you. Who is the best dressed character in Final Fantasy VI?
Oh, gosh. I mean... Well, there's a big difference between, like, the drawings in the instruction manual...
Sure.
...and what they actually look like as sprites, but I would say... I mean, Celis. I mean, that white flowy cape. Come on.
It's Celis. Just like, oh, gosh.
It's like Celine Dion at the Oscars a couple years ago.
Yes. All right, sir. Well, hold on to your thoughts and feelings about Final Fantasy, and we'll come back to them shortly. My next expert is also here on the mic with me. He's new to the show, and his name is...
Gavin Donnellan.
Welcome to the show, Gavin.
Hello.
So, Gavin, we've never had you on before, so I want to learn just a little bit about you.
Sure.
What type of nerd are you? Are you a movie guy, a gamer, anime? Like, what's
I am a Super Nintendo nerd.
Cool.
For sure.
Great. Anything else? You mentioned that you lived in Japan for a while, so you're an anime fan also?
I lived in Japan for 3 years. I actually was never a huge anime fan beforehand, but there's definitely certain ones I got really into, like Rurouni Kenshin. Is particularly one of my absolute favorites.
Cool. To bring it back to video games, you said Super Nintendo. What are some of your favorite games from your childhood or even today?
I still die hard true that I think Chrono Trigger is probably one of the best things that has ever been created.
Kind of like actually... Patrick Stewart.
Yes, right. it can do no wrong, much like Patrick Stewart. And yeah, I was actually just playing it this last week again. And that's one of my favorite games. I love Secret of Mana. I love, I actually love Mario RPG. I love, the Final Fantasies that are for Super Nintendo I think are great. The Illusion games I think are really good. There's, I just like the little tiny pixelated characters. Earthbound is another great one on that list.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. Well, hold on to your thoughts and feelings, sir. We will jump into the discussion shortly. My other experts are far, far away in mysterious lands. One of them is in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and his name is...
Zach Munn.
Welcome back, Zach.
Well, thank you for having me, Chris.
Always a pleasure, sir. So, I think the last podcast I had you on was the Video Games Music podcast. Is that correct?
I believe it was. Yeah, that was a fun show, and I actually talked a lot about Final Fantasy VI during that show.
I think you did, and we'll probably obviously talk about Nobuo Uematsu's music today. What are some of your favorite games, kind of games that you're currently playing and games that you grew up with?
Some of my favorite games. Well, I think we've even mentioned a couple on the list. Like Chrono Trigger definitely makes it near the top of that list. And most RPGs, like I love the same open world RPGs that John was talking about. Ni No Kuni was a big one that I played recently, which is tons of fun and a super beautiful game. And then I like some first person shooters from time to time.
Okay, awesome. Is Final Fantasy VI your favorite role-playing game?
Yes, hands down.
Ooh, all right. Then you are my favorite type of expert to have on.
I'm glad to be here, Chris.
Oh, great. Well, hold on to your thoughts and feelings, sir. We'll jump into it very shortly. My last expert has also been on before. He's over in New York, and his name is...
T. Scott Ross.
Hey, Scott. How you doing?
What's going on, Chris?
Not much. Nobody should be surprised that you're here at this point. So.
Oh, I've been waiting for this one, man. I've been waiting ever since. Anytime we talk about Final Fantasy, I've always managed to sneak in something about Final Fantasy VI. So now I'm actually allowed to talk about Final Fantasy VI. So that's fantastic.
You've made it abundantly clear that I was not allowed to record this or the Chrono Trigger podcast without you.
No, so. you're not allowed. You're just not allowed.
Yeah. Scott, just in case someone is hearing you for the first time, what type of gamer are you, and what are some of your favorite games from this era of the console generations?
Sure, I'm a love the old JRPGs, love them all. Also, I'm a big action RPG, huge Zelda fan. I love a good platformer, Mario Brothers and Donkey Kong, all of the the future incantations of those. And man, I'm a big Super Smash Brothers fan as well. I'm a Nintendo boy at heart, always have been, always will be.
Yes,
you'll be happy to know that Gavin is also a huge Smash Brothers fan. So
nice, we have to trade info in Smash Online then,
right?
Yes.
Scott, just a surprise question for you. Who is the worst character in Final Fantasy VI?
Well, if you'd asked me that, 15 years ago when I was a lot younger and hadn't played through it 12 times, I think at the time I'd only played through it 4 times, I would have said the worst character was Setzer. I never ever built Setzer up. I thought his ability was stupid and never gave him a time of day. But I think because I hated him so much, the last few times I was like, you know what? I'm going to make Setzer a badass. So I built him up and the coin ability, and by the end he was like the strongest character. I ended up giving him the Illumina sword, and he was a badass. So now that I really, really, truly know the ins and outs of every game, the worst character from a battle standpoint is actually Cyan or Kayan. He's the slowest character to get his super, 8 cleave ability or whatever that the Bushido they changed it to fill up that bar to 8 to get the super strong attack. But his story is really, really good.
All right. All right.
Anyway,
we'll talk about that.
You got me going. I'm saying. I know a lot.
I had thoughts on 30 things you said.
Well, excellent. We'll discuss this all in a moment. As is typical for my podcast, I brought on an outcast, someone who does not know as much about our topic today, and his name is...
Jeremy Connie.
Welcome back, Jeremy.
Thank you, Chris. Good to be here.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure to have you on, sir. So, I think we had you on the Final Fantasy IV podcast, so welcome back.
Thank you.
So, Jeremy... Let's just get to it. Why are you my outcast today?
Probably because I haven't played the game at all, and I've repeatedly angered T. Scott Ross by saying that I've only played from 7 on, and think that 7 is the best Final Fantasy game. I know, right? Isn't that such a delicious noise right there?
So, a couple of questions for you, Jeremy. What is your history, real quick, with the Final Fantasy series, and what other role-playing games or just video games in general have you played?
Oh, sure. Some of my favorite games include a couple that have been higher rated than Final Fantasy VI over the years, such as Legend of Zelda, A Link to the Past, Super Metroid, big fan of Zelda, big fan of Metroid, also Mega Man X as a series. Always into a lot of Nintendo hits and platformers like Mario, Smash Brothers. These are all great games.
So here's my question. You mentioned A Link to the Past and Super Metroid.
Yeah.
So obviously you hit some of the big greats on the Super Nintendo. How did you miss Final Fantasy?
You know, I just wasn't introduced to it for some reason. I remember the exact point when I had heard about Final Fantasy as a thing in high school. And people were talking about FF7. And I didn't know. I was so far outside of even knowing about what that was. I was like, guys, what does that mean? And I was I was a nerd. And then I was also just sort of not in whatever clique was talking about that. So they're like, oh, don't worry about it. It's nothing. We want to be cool. And so I got into Final Fantasy fairly late, and then even Final Fantasy VII fairly late. But it's always just been off of my radar for some reason. I didn't know about it.
Okay. Was the Super Nintendo the first home console that you owned, or did you have a Genesis or a regular Nintendo?
Oh, good question. I remember playing regular Nintendo, and I'm pretty sure our family had one, but I know I played Super Nintendo a lot, so I think we had that, and we might have had a Nintendo.
Okay.
I remember I played, after college, I played Nintendo with John Luce in Burger Time.
That's correct.
Yeah.
You guys just had a moment. John just got a little wispy-eyed over here.
You have to invite us back for the Burger Time podcast.
All right.
Can we?
I have a lot of thoughts on my favorite condiments. I really do.
Which is worse, the sausage or the egg? They're both terrible. But which is the worst?
Jeremy, remember, as my outcast, you have the conch of outcasts. So if we talk about something that you want to explore a little bit more, if you have questions or comments that you want to pose to the group, you have that power, sir.
Awesome.
Cool, gentlemen. Well, let's jump into discussing Final Fantasy VI.
Can I say something just for a hot minute?
Yeah, go for it.
Isn't it weird, like, saying, when I was talking about things just being off my radar as a kid, it just feels weird that that's a thing. Like, we didn't have the internet as a prevalent thing back then, so things were just coming in by people telling you about them. And that just feels so weird in retrospect.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of curious, how many of you were subscribed to Nintendo Power?
I was not.
Yeah,
I was.
Yeah.
So almost all of us?
Not me.
Yeah. I had a subscription. I had the map from the second playthrough of Zelda tacked up on my wall.
Oh, that's awesome. I always wanted Nintendo Power. It was just a luxury.
It was really the only source of information. We could actually really have a podcast about Nintendo Power. But yeah. let's drift back to Final Fantasy.
Yes.
Released in 1994, produced by Hironobu Sakaguchi, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, with designs by Yoshitaka Amano, and of course, a musical score by Nobuo Uematsu. Released by Squaresoft. Released in the United States is Final Fantasy III. Were any of you aware, Zach, let me actually start with you on this. Were you aware that once again we had skipped a Final Fantasy, namely Final Fantasy V, and jumped from 4 to 6? Were you aware of that?
No, not as a kid. In fact, I got the Final Fantasy, it was Final Fantasy III when I purchased it, and it was my very first experience with the Final Fantasy series, so here I was playing this game where I was like, well, what are the first two like? What is this game even about, you know? Then played through and kind of filled in my Final Fantasy history later back, you know, when I was like, well, that game was awesome. What are the rest like? And then Final Fantasy VII, obviously, huge disappointment.
Zach, why did you pick it up if you had no experience prior?
The word of a friend, you know, you were talking about like the pre-internet days, and it was all the word of a friend. A friend of mine named Sean was like, "Yeah, you got to check this game out. It's super awesome." And then I started playing it, and it didn't take me much longer than the opening Magitek chapter to get super hooked into it.
What were some of your first impressions playing it back then? Do you remember?
I would have to say like the mood, I think, was the biggest impression that I got, because it sets this whole tone, and then it sets up new tones as the game goes on, and it sort of drags you into this way of, like, every new storyline they talk about, you know, you're really experiencing this cool aspect of the story. You know, there's like a ghost story thing when you go fight the ghost train, and then there's, you know, the cool technology side when the castle burrows under the sand. And then there's that whole post-apocalyptic thing that happens in the second half of the game. Like, it's a whole series of really interesting moments tacked together.
Scott, let me jump over to you. How do you respond to some of the stuff that Zach just threw out?
Oh, I completely agree about tone. That game sets you up, and there's like a flyover shot of Narsh, and you're in the steampunk world, and they set you up right in the middle of the story. They give you a history. The world, 1,000 years ago, there was a great war of the Magi, very Greek tragedy, that the huge grand event has already happened, and this is all the aftermath of a brand new story. The mystery of finding a frozen thing, and they don't know what it is, and your lead character is being controlled at the time. It's, man, they just, right off the bat, it's just home run, right off the bat.
Did you play this in 1994?
I did. I had it right when it came out.
And now, was this your first Final Fantasy, or had you played the others at this point?
No, I had played the original Final Fantasy, and I had even played Mystic Quest, which we don't really
say. Oh, Mystic Quest. Yeah. Oh,
may she rest. Mystic Quest.
It's one of the best songs in it, though.
Scott, what do you remember? What were some of your first impressions from back then in 94? Do you remember?
I just remember falling in love with each and every character and amazed at how developed, you know, of course, this is 1994. I'm 13 years old, so I'm worrying about character development. But I immediately had a connection, an emotional connection to every character, to the characters. I fell in love with, you know, with Terra. I fell in love with Celeste and had to figure out, oh, which one do I really love more? I love them both so great, you know? And Locke, the cool thief, the, you know, with the returners, and just character after character. You fall in love with them. They're all so incredibly unique. They're all so incredibly diverse. And I think that's because, I mean, the producers of the game, they split the duties of developing the characters between the three of them, which is, it really shows, you know, one person did these three characters and their storyline, another producer did these three characters, and then one guy was in charge of making all those characters come together. And this game in particular, it really shows that each character is so amazingly diverse, and then there's an overarching thing that pulls them all together, all 14 of them.
Let me jump to my two experts sitting here in the room with me. John, let's start with you. How do you respond to some of all the things that have been said so far?
I absolutely agree. I always come back to this game as being a kind of an amazing example of ensemble in a game. I mean, the standard for a role-playing game is to have a group of people to save the world, but there's usually like the 14-year-old hero with the crazy hair, and then like the girl he loves, and they're kind of like the two main characters, and then the rest are just kind of have they're like one thing, one quirk on the side, you know? Whereas this feels very like Robert Altman-esque, where everyone has a deep, sometimes very dark story. There's not really a lead character. It switches up, not just halfway through, but throughout. You're following different storylines at different points, and they all are just, yeah, they're so incredibly nuanced and tragic and beautiful, and it's very, very hard to pick a favorite.
Gavin, what do you think?
Yeah, I think for me, I think this was the first game I ever actually I bought myself. The first role playing game I ever played was Final Fantasy II or IV, and I fell in love with the style. And I this actually is why this particular game is actually why I got into playwriting, because it's I'm serious. It's just the way it was written. I think from the very beginning, like when it does that like for Super Nintendo, the whole like cutscene of them of the three mech armors walking forward with the music playing in was just so like a movie introduction. It was a very it had such an epic feel to it, and I think I just remember just being absolutely enwrapped with this game. And like when the story splits three different ways and you have to pick the different characters and it goes off in that direction, like John was just saying. And I loved that, I loved that, like, ensemble aspect, and I definitely had characters I loved more than others, for me, but I do, and all the characters are they're very flawed as well, which I thought was very interesting. A lot of them make sizable mistakes, and, yes. Yeah, I just thought it was, I think, like, in the difference between, I think, 4 and 6 is that, like, in 4, all the main characters, except for obviously Cecil in the beginning, are pretty much like, they're wonderful. And I love that game because it's my first one. But this one, a lot of characters make sizable mistakes in this and anger each other. And it was just, it was interesting. It was a very dramatic game. And I think that it's one of the, for being so many different characters, it was actually very focused. Which I kind of feel like, the, in my personal opinion, the later Final Fantasies, in my opinion, get a little out of control.
A little focus.
I did. I actually lost my heart for the series later.
One thing you've all mentioned that I kind of want to throw out there, you've all talked about this being kind of a ensemble piece, very character-driven. I think this is officially, has the most character, playable characters of any of the Final Fantasies. And obviously it's juggling the most plot lines. I think there are 14 characters. Maybe 12?
Yep. 14. 14.
14? All right.
Yes. Yeah, because it's the three groups of it plus two extra.
Yeah. I was recently playing this, obviously, for the podcast, and there's a couple things I want to talk about. Zach, you mentioned that each, this is kind of a series of just, like, small stories and scenes all kind of really tightly woven together. And one thing that I find really refreshing is you start the game, and although there is no really main protagonist, you start the game as a woman. You start the game as Terra. And then when you get to the halfway point, you restart the game as Celeste, which I think is a really interesting design choice to always stick you with the females, which I love. But the tone of the game is very strange to me, and I really noticed it on this last playthrough. Like, you have bits of... when, like, you first meet Gal, he and Sabin have this fun little dance that they do on the battle screen. When Terra uses magic for the first time, Locke and Edgar, like, kind of do this comedic moment on the battle screen. There's a lot of, like, funny comedic moments, and of course we'll talk about the opera scene. And then, of course, in the second half of the game is the apocalypse. And you have characters trying to commit suicide and who have completely lost their way, or who have given up hope. The tone of the game is very, very fascinating to me. How do you all react to the tone of the game? Especially the first half and the second half, because they are markedly different.
That to me was the thing that, I mean, like I said, it grabbed me and it made me love the game, right? So, like, you know, this was years and years back, you know, we're talking pre-internet days here. And for you to really love a game, you had to experience it. You couldn't hear about it. You couldn't, you know, get excited about it beforehand. You just started playing it, and then it was either hit or miss. So when this game came along that was so full of story and so full of interesting things that wasn't a platformer, you know, I fell hard for it, you know. And then here I am playing this game, and, you know, I know that all of you guys had the same experience, but you're playing through the first half of the game, and you think that's it. You know, I had no idea about the second half of this game. And here I am in the last moments of this game, and the continents, you know, falling from the sky, and the world gets destroyed. And I'm shocked as a kid watching this. Like, what is happening? Did I get the bad ending? What did I do? And, you know,
you got the really bad ending.
Yeah, I was like, what did I screw up? And then you wake up on a beach, and, you know, your new mission after controlling all of this magic and having all of this destructive power at your fingertips. Now your new mission is to get a fish for a dying old man, you know. And
pick the right one.
Yeah, and for me it was like, oh my god, what is this even? I have to know exactly what happened to everyone. I've got to track everyone down, and even without them telling me, I was raring to go and get back out in the world and figure out, you know, where all my party was, which I, you know, like I haven't had a game do that quite so well since.
Gavin, you were about to say something about the tone also.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting because the end of the game, the world doesn't go... It's not like at the end everything's great. Like, it is ruined. And I that's one of the things I thought was interesting too, is you don't even have to go back and get these people. Like, you don't even have to recollect them all. Like, you could actually just assume some of them are gone forever. And I thought that was just... It was very interesting. And every single one of the people you recollect are... in just a very dark situation. I actually, most people like the opera scene. My actual favorite part of the game is Setzer going to the Forgotten Tomb.
Oh.
And I just think it's what a very interesting and bold choice. And it was just, I remember when I was young, just being like, it's just incredibly dark and very, very sad. And all these characters go through a massive level of loss. And they don't get it back. Like, at the end, there's not, like, a congratulations, everything's okay. It's just congratulations, we stopped a further destruction, mm-hmm. which I think is interesting.
Yeah. Scott, what about you?
The World of Light, World of Balance just blew my mind when I played this game. You had two different overworlds, and you get to revisit all the places that you visited in the first half of the game, and everything's messed up, and all the people are just trying to get by, trying to survive. These are very dark. We've already said they're very dark themes, but these are very heavy themes for a 13-year-old child, you know, even like getting the fish for the old man who's dying, and then he dies. And then the only way Celeste realizes that she can go on is that she can't. So she attempts to kill herself. Like, she throws herself off the cliff, and magically she survives. And then when she gets back, she realizes there's a wrath and that she can go with the note. Oh my gosh! Like, it's just phenomenal. And the love stories, which are kind of love stories but not. You know, you have Locke and Celeste. Obviously, you know, Locke saves Celeste from the Empire, and that's kind of, you know, the person he's helps her out in the opera. But the whole time, Locke's dealing with the loss that he blames himself for losing his love, Rachel, which you find out if you go and find Locke. And that whole scene, you know, when she comes back to life because of the Phoenix, only for a little bit to tell him that it's okay, I don't blame you, live your life. Like, these themes are just intense and beautiful and perfect.
Mm-hmm. John, is it perfect? Guide us, John.
I mean, it's pretty perfect, let's be honest. I want to go back to something you said, Chris, about how you start as Terra, and then when the game restarts halfway through, you start as Celeste. And being a little gay boy growing up in the Midwest, like, I love that so much. And it's even now, I'm playing Tales of Symphonia, and there's such a standard way to start RPGs where you're that plucky 14-year-old kid in a sunshiny village, and then there's some, like, drain on the earth, and you have to go fix it. And you have, like...
Boy, that sounds like Final Fantasy VII.
Doesn't it?
I mean, it sounds like Zelda, too.
or Chrono Trigger, take your pick.
And then
fair.
You have like your love interest, and she's always magic based. She's always a mage or a healer or something. Very, you know, like dainty. And she wears cloaks and ribbons. Whereas you have Terra, and not only get one incredibly strong, detailed, nuanced female protagonist, you get two. And then you also have the other female characters as well, who are also great. But you actually. To me, those are two of the main biggest protagonists of the game, and they're both so diverse. And Celeste is a general, and she's a badass in battle. She's not just a wimpy, magey, cloaky, ribbony, like spangly dress wearing, you know. Mm-hmm. She's a warrior, and it's amazing that you get to that. The characters are not just interesting for that game; they're interesting for all games. They're interesting in comparison to any RPG you put up against it.
I mean, if you compare them to the direct antecedent from Final Fantasy IV, Rosa, like, Rosa's great. I do like the Cecil-Rosa relationship, but Rosa is not a general. She's not walking around in magic tech armor.
Yeah. Both females.
Yeah,
Rydia,
both.
Too. Rydia is also the magic users.
Yeah, and they always have, like, 300 less hit points than the males, and it's just like...
They stand in the back with that crappy whip.
Back row, yeah.
Yeah, back row, yeah.
Jeremy, let me jump over to you.
Sure.
How are you doing over there, Jeremy? Do you have any thoughts or anything that we've said so far that you want us to explore?
A lot of the stuff is a bit unrelatable since I haven't played it, and it fits for me in terms of the context in comparison to other games. So a lot of my questions are dealing with the Final Fantasy series, and also just what this game does that other games didn't do at the time.
Ugh, what is this game? Did you ask what is this game doing that did that other games at the time didn't do?
I have some structured questions that are we going right now?
Yeah, we're going.
Oh, great. I wanted to know what sort of having played Final Fantasy VII and a lot of parts of other Final Fantasy games past VII, there's a lot of Final Fantasy tropes or just repeated things, much like Zelda has. The chocobos, airships, Moogles, stuff that basically all Final Fantasies do. And I wanted to know if Final Fantasy VI started doing any of these, if it started doing stuff in the Final Fantasy series that every game after it agreed, okay, that was great, that was genius, let's keep doing that.
I can take that. Because honestly, I can only think of one specific thing, maybe two, but one real specific thing that Final Fantasy VI did first was the desperation attack. And this became limit breaks in Final Fantasy VII and overdrive in Final Fantasy X. Now it's in every Final Fantasy game in some way, shape, or form. This was actually very rare and not very easy to get. Your characters had to be at low.
I've never seen two of them.
Yeah, actually, I've only seen two, but every character has one. I saw Celeste's and I saw Sabin's.
Yes, me too. Those are the ones I've ever seen.
Yeah, those are the ones I've seen too. Actually, you can look at a YouTube video and they'll show you all 14 of them. And they're all amazing and they all instantly kill the enemy. But that was the first game to do that. Also, this game really let you customize your characters. If you wanted Locke to be a magic user, you could equip him with an Esper that gave him boost to his magic, mm-hmm. and you could teach him all the magic spells, and he'd be a magic user. If you wanted Locke to be a warrior, you would equip Zone Seek, and he'd get plus 10 to his vigor every single time he leveled up. You give him the Illumina, the Genji Club, and the Offering, and you have a Warhammer beast of a warrior. So you could make any, even if they were, you could make Realm. Realm was more of a magic user and she painted, but you could make her a warrior if you wanted to, if you devoted the time to build up the character exactly the way you wanted to. And the other game, you really couldn't do that. Like Rosa was a white mage. That's what she did. You know, Cecil turned into a paladin. That's what he did. So it was really the first one to really let you customize. And more thing, I want to bring this up because we'll talk about this too. Especially compared to other future Final Fantasies, it's the only game where the bad guy at the beginning of the story is a weak, awful pussy. He's terrible. He's not that strong. You beat him in three hits the very first time you ever fight him. He's a coward. He's insane. He's crazy. He's not that great. You think that all of these other, the Emperor and all these other big guys are really the bad guys, but it's that little twerp. He's the one who messed with the statues and is granted this great, unbelievable power. It's such a turn. Sephiroth is just super strong from the beginning. Zimmeros and Golbez are unbeatable at the beginning of the game. Final Fantasy IV. Final Fantasy VIII, you know, the Edea and the Sorceress, they are max power at the beginning of the game. It's the only one where the bad guy is a weakling and he becomes the ultimate deity, the ultimate power.
Yeah, he has an arc too. You know, Kefka has this whole
Absolutely.
Thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah, he builds up and it's interesting to watch that happen, you know, the same time that your characters are going through the same journey.
Gavin, Zach, Scott threw out something that I kind of want to focus on real quick. The battle system, or the Esper system. Jeremy, since you've played Final Fantasy VII and IX, did you play VIII?
I've played portions of all of them.
The Esper since system seven. Is really, I feel, is a little similar probably to the Junction system from VIII, mm-hmm. Or maybe a combination of the Junction and the Materia system from VII. It's always, Scott was right. Like, you really can make whoever you want be really whatever you want. Certain characters are locked into certain things. Like, Sabin has his blitz technique. Saiyan has his Bushido. And different characters do have, like, specialized portions to themselves, kind of like the job system. But, like, the magic and the stats, you can manipulate pretty heavily, and it's a real joy when you like get a new Esper and it's like yeah. Oh, now I have four new spells, and oh, it adds to my stamina if I level up. Oh my god, that's so cool. Which I like the materia system actually from 7 a lot too.
Great system.
Oh, I love materia. Mm-hmm. I haven't come across one that's better.
Well, I think the Esper system is infinitely more usable than the Junction system. Mm-hmm. The Junction system I just find to be horrible.
What about the materia system?
I didn't mind that. I like that. I thought that was much more easy to use. I just hate the Junction system. We'll talk about that during the Final Fantasy VIII cast.
Yeah.
but what I loved about the Espers, too, is that they're not just like crystals you get, or they're not just items you get. They're characters. They're not people. They're Espers. But they're,
and to be dark, they're dead characters.
They're dead characters, man. Oh.
Oh, really?
So there's this whole sadness to their existence and collecting them and what they're going through and their annihilation, it's such a cool aspect to the battle system that you're using actually like these dead beings that are helping you from beyond. It's so cool.
It is really creepy, and like one of them is actually like the father of one of the characters, which you find out later on. But yeah,
he's already dead when you get it.
He's already dead.
Yeah.
It's like they decided to take all the summoned monsters from previous Final Fantasies and really like give them a backstory, and then in order for you to use them, like they have to be dead, which is really freaking morose.
they can kill themselves sometimes. Yeah.
But one thing we haven't talked to, jump back to the tone real quick. Like, this is a world where science currently rules supreme. And it's a world where magic is coming back. You know, the Empire wants to find these Espers to take their magic. And what nobody realizes is to use this magic, like, the Esper has to die, essentially. So it's an interesting world where magic is coming back, kind of like Game of Thrones, almost. And, I mean, spoiler alert, at the end of the game, magic fades from the world, which is kind of depressing, too.
What?
What? Yeah, I know, right?
It's a very weird ending.
This game has everything.
It
just kind of fades out. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anything else you guys want to say about the system? Because Zach brought up something that I really want to talk about.
I think this was also the first Final Fantasy. Yeah, it is. The first Final Fantasy where you create your whole party. You can actually trade everyone out, which is a feature of the later games, like 7, 8, and all them. This is the first one of the series where you can actually, like, just, you pick the four people that you are using. Which I think that was a development of this. I think this and Chrono Trigger might have been the first two to do that.
Yeah, you're locked. You have Chrono in your party.
Until he dies.
Yeah, until he dies.
Spoiler alert!
No!
Spoiler! Everyone dies. Sort of.
What?
Ah! And then you get to use him. No, he becomes an Esper. I don't know.
Man.
Esper? I want to quit that.
What were you saying, Jeremy?
Other than the ending, apparently, I was just marveling in how energy efficient this world is in terms of intellectual energy. People live and then die, and then after they die, you can still use them. They can still contribute to the world, and that's really cool. That's just really efficient.
Final Fantasy VI starts this tone that the next few Final Fantasies march in the same direction of a steampunk.
It's very
kind of world.
Miyazaki-esque, actually.
Yeah.
Miyazaki does the similar, if you've ever seen his films.
And, I mean, I don't want to dwell too much on this, but Final Fantasy VII obviously explores, like, technology and draining the world of its resources. Mm-hmm. And then Final Fantasy VIII is, like, batshit crazy science magic. So they definitely... They
guns
do this...
and blades?
What? Yeah.
Except for the card game.
And zippers. Oh, they do this march towards more of a science fiction direction with their tones. But this is kind of the one that started it. Because Final Fantasy IV and Final Fantasy V were not very tech-heavy. There wasn't a lot of technology in the world. There were airships, but this is the one
and
where
the
you
lunar,
have, like...
The lunar whale, but the lunar whale was ancient technology. So they started. They're like, okay, you're gonna go to the moon in the lunar whale. Okay, cool.
Cool. We'll get in it.
Yeah, anything else you guys want to say about the system real quick?
I actually don't like that everyone can learn every spell. Like, I will say, like, between, like, I hated 8. I hated Final Fantasy 8. But, like, I loved finding the Magicite and all of that. I thought was really cool. And then in 7 with the Materia. The fact of all of them, I actually liked in 9, going through the whole set of series, how in 9 it was similar, but each character could only learn certain things. Mm. Mm-hmm. And I liked that only because one of the things, because 4 still is one of my favorite games, and I liked that each character was very specific in what they offered in those sets. And for me, with my one grievance actually with Final Fantasy VI is like certain characters become obsolete. Like, I actually have zero use for Locke by the end. He serves no purpose to me because his special stuff, like Steel, and he just hits and he's useless. So I end up locking into the characters that have like the special ability that adds something to it, like Sabin or Edgar, because you can just teach all of them magic. And it kind of, to me, diminishes Terra and Celis because they're the ones who can use magic, but in the end, it's like, so can everyone else. Bye.
I would definitely say that's definitely a fair criticism. I mean, to use Sabin as an example, like, his blitz technique is really cool.
It's phenomenal.
But if you build him up as a magic user, you can build him up in a way that his special skills are kind of pointless. And you can really kind of do that to almost anybody. So there is this trade-off of everybody's customizable, but they can lose something. Mm-hmm. You know, you can. How do my other experts? How do you respond to that? Did you guys kind of get a similar feeling, like, oh, this is so wonderfully customizable, but then kind of saw that side of it too? Or
I have to say that I completely disagree. I think it's the strength of the game, not its one weakness. And that's because if there's a specific character that their story emotionally connects to you, you can make that character the protagonist of your story. The way the game was created, we said this before, every character is the protagonist of the story. And Locke was personally my favorite character. At the end of the game, Locke was the character who I gave the Illumina and the Atma weapon and the Genji glove and the offering, and he was destroying, mowing down people left and right. One time, I made him a magic user. Like, every time you play the game, you can put a different character in a different situation. And as far as teaching all the characters every spell, it's about the world. In the world, magic is returning to this world. These people are all, most of them are non-magic users, and now all of a sudden, they have the ability to use magic. And at the beginning of the game, these people rely on their special skills. Sabin relies on his blitz techniques. Even Edgar relies on his, you know, his tools, the auto crossbow and the chainsaw. The first half of the game, those are unbelievable things. But once magic is returned to the world, magic is obviously the most powerful thing. So I think I have absolutely no problem with that aspect of the game.
Yeah, that's interesting. Thematically, that makes sense, that magic would, you know, override the special powers of people. That's interesting. Zach, what do you think?
Yeah, when I first started playing the game, I loved how customizable it was. I didn't think of it that way, but when I started playing and then they opened it up where Espers could make anyone a magic user, it didn't feel like a limitation at all. It felt like, oh, this is great. Now I can, if I want to make this guy a healer in a certain fight, like, I can make this guy a healer. Like, whenever I had to have, like, Strago in my party, like, I would just make him a healer, and he would take a full round every time to heal everyone up. And I thought that was marvelous, you know? Like, if I wanted to concentrate on Edgar's, you know, tool ability, I could. If I wanted to have him hang back and either heal or provide a little magic support, that could happen too. It didn't ever seem like a limitation to me. It felt like a really cool way to open up. And, you know, it gave you this opportunity to make, you know, 3 or 4 different tanks if you wanted to, as far as characters went.
John, I put you in the last position again. What do you think about the system?
I agree. I think it adds to the replayability of it a lot. The first few times I played it through, I was, you know, I don't know how old, I was 12 maybe, so I didn't understand the nuance of the game by any means. And so it took me a couple times playing it through where I realized in that second half you really can take the characters that you love and you can strengthen them up and you can make them badasses. Like, I remember the first time I played through, I thought Realm was like the most worthless character. I thought she had no abilities. Like, I thought it was kind of like interesting that she could paint, but then I think the second or third time I played through, I just was like, well, I'm going to use her no matter what. And I ended up turning her into this ginormous badass who basically helped me beat the game the first time I actually ever beat it. And I thought that was totally awesome that you can take these characters. There's not any characters that are inherently weak. You can take the characters that you love and you can make them strong. Because I think a lot of times games have the characters that you're supposed to favor and you're supposed to use and make it easier to use, and the characters that are just kind of there for fun and they don't really add a whole lot. But this one, every character can be your go-to if you really want them to.
Did we kind of answer your question, Jeremy?
Yeah, you, and several that I didn't even ask.
Here's a question I want to throw out to everybody, since we're talking about characters real quick. Who was your favorite character? Who was your favorite character as far as techniques and, you know, usefulness in battle? And who was your favorite character just as a written character in this game? And I'll go first to give everyone a quick moment to think. I always really enjoyed Sabin as far as techniques to use. Throwing in a little Street Fighter or Mortal Kombat in there was kind of fun to use his blitz techniques, which, Jeremy, you don't know this, but you have to enter his commands kind of like a finishing move that you would in a fighting game.
Okay.
Which is, I think they did this again with Zell later on in Final Fantasy VIII. I'm trying to remember if Zell worked
the same
way. He looked
similar. I don't remember if he had the same...
Story-wise, I've always been a huge fan of Cyan. He goes through so much. I mean, you only spend about a minute with him, and then his world is destroyed as his family is poisoned and killed. So the world has already ended for him long before the world actually ends. And one of my favorite moments, which I'll talk about later, actually involves him. But he's kind of like this, Ronin knight who's lost his kingdom and he's in his 50s, and he doesn't really relate well to technology. He kind of feels a little out of place. He doesn't trust Celeste because she works with the Empire. I've always really just enjoyed his character. Those are my two. Zach, let's jump to you. Who's your favorite character technique-wise to use that you always enjoyed using, and who do you think is one of the more well-written characters?
Well, for technique, I have to agree with you, Sabin or Sabin. I never knew how to say that.
I chose Sabin too.
Yeah.
Sabin, yeah. He was just the most like pure fun as far as like technique goes. Like having to enter that in every time and getting it right, like at a crucial moment in a battle, was kind of rewarding, right? Story wise, I have to go with Shadow, because Shadow caused my second playthrough of this game. I don't know what you guys did, but I had no idea you could save him at the mm-hmm. turn of the game.
I had no idea either.
Nope.
And so I played through the second half, and then you get this sad little coda at the end of the game that's like, "And Shadow died." And
oh God.
Yeah, and it's kind of devastating. And then I talk to people and realize, oh wow, you can wait for him and he lives. And I was super depressed that I missed that, and so I went back through and played it back through, and what I love about Shadow's story is that you really have to try to get his story. Like, if you have him in a party at a certain juncture of the game, like if you go and meet Strago in Realm, or if you're with Celeste at certain moments, like, you start to get his backstory, which I thought was really cool, and I was really fascinated by it because it was never direct, or was rarely direct. It was rarely like the first thing you were dealing with,
or the dreams.
And so I was always intrigued. Like, well, what is this guy? What did he do? What happened to his family? What's his deal? Why is he the loneliest person? And why do I like him so much?
Yeah, because you get a bunch of his story just by hoping that when you sleep at an inn with him, you'll see part of his stories.
Exactly. Right. So you have to really make an effort in order to get his story, and then his story is just little fragments here and there, and you kind of piece the rest of it together in your head, which I thought was super cool. Like, they never give you the direct, like, this is the answer to Shadow. You always have to assume a lot of stuff happens.
Let's also not forget that he has the coolest dog in the entire fucking world.
Interceptor!
I freaking love that dog.
Oh, so crucial in a fight when he would jump in and chew someone's neck off. God, that was great.
It was always so thrilling when it happened in a boss fight, and you're like, oh, thank God.
Yeah, definitely my favorite. Although at any moment I could change and say, no, this guy's my favorite now. This guy, like, they've all got such great reasons to recommend them, except for the Sasquatch, who I hated.
Umara.
John, let me jump over to you here in the room. Who's same questions to you?
I mean, my standard answer to that has always been Celeste. Or I always call her Celeste.
Me too.
But then I think about it, if you added a T, it's Celeste, so maybe it is Celeste.
Like the pizza.
Yeah. I just love that she's part of the Empire, and she's this torn general who's done some horrible things, and she's dealing with that. And then, of course, getting to use her after the world ends. I mean, she's part of the most, for me, the most impactful part, some of the most impactful parts of the show, the Opera House and the island. So she'd be my standard answer, but the more I play it, actually, I really love Gao. Just because he's such a tragic character, even though he's so goofy and weird, and he's not, on the surface, tragic, but, like, his father, who rejects him and does not want anything to do with him, like, that's horrifying. That's horrible.
His mom died in childbirth, is my guess.
Yeah, his mom died in childbirth.
So even though he's kind of the least articulate, and his story is not quite as prevalent as other people's stories.
He's simple. Like, he's not a very intelligent.
There's some real tragedy behind him that is, the more I play it, the more I just fall in love with him.
Oh, he has that scene too where, like, they dress him up to kind of make him look normal.
Oh, man.
Take him to his dad, and he
still rejects him.
Still rejects him. Scott, what about you?
I'd have to say, technique wise, just because she really is the original Super Saiyan. I would say I love Terra's morph ability. She's just a badass character. I mean, no matter if she's a magic user, a fighter, whatever you do, she morphs and turns into that super hot white being with the long white hair, and it's just like she's gonna wreck some havoc on your face. And then my favorite character, I've already mentioned it, it's Locke. To me, Locke is the Han Solo of the game, and he's one of the first characters you get introduced. He's with the Returners, he's with the Rebellion, and then his backstory is so sad. The Rebellion caused his childhood love to die, and it's really cool in the second part of the game that you have to find Locke in the Phoenix Cave, which is what a crazy maze. Two different parties activating buttons and activating things so you can pass through to find Locke at the center of the Phoenix Cave. I just connected so much with him. Awesome character. And it's really cool. You get his mug ability, and you're stealing all these cool items, and you're fighting at the same time. Rock and roll.
Gavin?
I don't know. Maybe it was my little gay boy self. I loved... I did love Saban. I did. Let's say it. Like, also...
He's wearing a tank top.
I know. It was also right when I was starting to get into acting. I was like, if there's a movie, this is the character I'm going to play. I did like him. I loved his ability-wise. My favorite character in the game is actually Realm. I think, similar to Gao, I think her storyline is remarkably sad. Also, I bought one of the first versions of the game that had the glitch in it, with the sketch glitch, where if you got out of it, you got the weird, like, infinite of everything.
Oh,
I loved her, and I loved the fake mustache. First of all, I love picturing a little girl running around with a fake mustache. and that she could control, which was the only way to get all of Strago, however you say his name, all of his blue magic. Really with her, by controlling them.
Mm-hmm.
She had my favorite music in the game, and she... she's another example of, like, she's this very little, like, little plucky little girl, but her backstory is awful as well, because, like, you figure out the Shadow is her father, and she has no parents. Like, Strago's just, she calls him grandfather, but has no blood relation to her either, I believe, is what they hint at. And you find her as well, like, just, like, in a cave, like, in the second half. Like, she's just, I just thought she was a very... very intriguing character. Well, you find her with the painter, and then she disappears. Yeah. It depends whether or not you've saved Shadow.
Mm-hmm. It's a really cool moment where, when you first meet her, Interceptor is actually really kind to her.
Yeah, and you start to piece it together.
And you're like, whoa, wait, what? That dog likes nobody. What is going on?
I just want to mention this, too, because this is one of my favorite parts of the game. It's very simple and very small, but how every character gets introduced with the black text and the music and the the little bit of
text. Hers is beautiful.
It's such beautifully written, and they're just such cute little, just great little moments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we didn't mention this, but the translation for this game, which I think was done by Ted Woosley, is really, really good. I mean, Final Fantasy IV had some translation, just some odd translation bits, but
Spoony Bard.
I love Spoony Bard.
Oh, I love Spoony Bard.
Right?
Is that where this comes from? Spoony Bard comes from 4, but it's legendary. Spoony Bard.
Yeah. Right.
Thank you for mentioning that, John. Like that, I think that really hammers home that this is a character ensemble driven story. It's Jeremy. Yeah, we didn't mention this. Whenever you get a character, like when you meet them, the screen cuts to black and it's just them standing in the center of the screen, and then this narration comes up kind of describing their character. Really cool.
With their theme song.
Yeah. Sidebar, one of the coolest birthday gifts I ever gave was my boyfriend in college. I custom made him a shirt because Setzer was his favorite, and the back was the script. With the art version of the character where they drew him like the actual artistic flourish. Very gay. But and then his icon version in the bottom corner of the shirt, just because that was why he loved that character, was because of that text.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
For a Setzer, that's why it was his favorite.
That's really cool.
Final Fantasy and not talk about the villain. We've already kind of mentioned it. Kefka is the main villain for this game. Although, I would argue you don't really know that for a while. Final Fantasy 1, 4, 5, I feel they do a pretty good job of saying, this is your villain.
4 does a flip too, though.
4 does do a flip.
At the very, very last second.
In Final Fantasy VI, it's Jestal in the Empire, and Kefka's kind of, better terms, he's a clown.
He's drawing a clown.
Zach, you mentioned, you kind of see him develop, which is really cool. And then there's a very specific moment where Kefka just takes the power.
Yeah.
Hates when he kills Leo.
Yeah. I fucking hate when he kills Leo, I know.
He's one of the best characters, too.
I know! He's so cool.
I was that's who I was looking for the whole time, thinking I was going to get it back.
Yeah.
Because there's the two slots that don't fill.
Yep.
I assumed he was one of the slots.
Yep. So let's talk about Kefka, who I would describe as the Joker. I mean, he's kind of the Joker of Final Fantasy. I don't think anybody else has come along that's like him. And he's very similar to the Joker in some respects. He's literally dressed as a clown. You know, he's a little flamboyant, a lot of flamboyant.
Yeah.
He's kind of a fool. He even has comedic bits when you first meet him of, being knocked over and by chocobos and stuff like that. And then he causes the destruction of the world. So,
good God.
What do you guys want to say about Kefka? Who wants to start this one off?
I'll start. I think he's one of the few villains who you truly want to destroy. I feel like so many villains main villains in RPGs are just, you're supposed to beat them. You don't actually have an emotional need to destroy their whole life. I want to kill Kefka. He's so annoying. His laugh, just the stuff he does, killing Leo, all the stuff he does, he just makes you hate him so much that when you actually do beat him, it's the greatest feeling in the world. It's not just, I leveled up enough and I finally beat this anonymous boss. It's he's a force of evil that annoys the hell out of you, and when you destroy him, it's so cathartic.
Yeah, I think him and Golbez, Golbez seems that way, and then Golbez does the turn. Yeah, I agree with him, yeah. A lot of the other ones, they try to give a shred of humanity to, which I always think is actually proper writing, is always to give a bad guy some kind of empathetic spin, why they got to where they are. There is no reason why he got the way he is. Just bad.
There is.
Well,
true.
But there's not an I don't feel like there's an empathetic side to him.
That's
true. You never see it. that's the problem. Like, in I just saw this in the game. There's a point where you find out Kefka is the first Magitek Knight. Like, yes. He's the first one they ever tried that process on, but something went wrong. So that kind of made him
crazy.
Made him a little screwy. So you never see what Kefka was like before that.
I assume he drank some of the poison with cyan.
But yeah, there's not. He's batshit crazy. Like, he's the most chaotic, I think, of all the Final Fantasy villains. He doesn't. His goal is to create a monument to nothing. Like, he doesn't want anything. Like, he gets it. Like, he screws up the world. He does what he wants to do. And Zach, that, Scott, and what do you guys think?
That last fight, it always impressed me how beautiful that last fight is, right? Musically, and then when you finally fight Kefka, and it's this huge, towering, like, sort of, like, demonic angel that looks beautiful. I mean, by 16-bit standards, this looked beautiful. And it's this big difference from this sort of clown that you were pummeling, you know, in the first half of the game. And at the end, he's this being that's worthy of your hatred, you know? Like, you have really earned this fight, and it's like John says, it's very cathartic.
You know, demonic angel sounds very familiar. Sounds a lot like Sephiroth.
Oh, I'm listening.
Yeah, well, sounds like and is are two totally different things, aren't they, Chris?
I'm saying Kefka came first.
Damn right he did.
So, Kefka, I mean, what an amazingly evil, heinous, it's already been said, I'll say it again, you don't hate any bad guy like you hate Kefka. When you get to him at the end, he's like, life, dreams, hope, where they come from, where are they headed? His aim is to destroy everything good that's in the world. That cackle laugh that you hear, and just the fact that he was, like, you don't realize in the beginning of the game that this is going to be the stupid person you have to deal with the rest of the game. You know, oh, it's the Empire, oh, it's this, oh, it's that. No, it's that little twerp who got ran over by the chocobos, that little twerp who you killed so easily at the beginning of the game with that stupid clowny laugh. Oh, man. He's, in my opinion, he is by far the best villain in any Final Fantasy game.
A couple questions to all my experts. John, we'll start with you. Did you know Kefka was going to be the big bad for this? Was that telegraphed pretty obviously to you, or was it a surprise? And is Kefka the best Final Fantasy villain?
Yes, he is the best Final Fantasy villain. Okay. I'll say that first. I had no idea that he was going to be the actual main boss. I think I assumed he was just going to be like one of the henchmen that you beat, probably, like I'm because after you beat him the first time and he's not dead, you're like, oh, he'll come back, but he'll be like someone I face off like 3/4 of the way through the game as like a henchman. He won't be the boss. I always thought that, you know, the Stahl was going to be the boss, or some monster behind Stahl or something, you know, because that's what I learned from Final Fantasy IV.
Right, you almost think of Kefka as like one of the four fiends.
Yeah,
like he's a servant. Yeah. Gavin, what do you think?
I think he is the best villain they've had. Him and Golbez are the two best I think they've ever done. I figured it out by the poisoning. Mm. The poisoning with cyan is where I was like, all right, this.
Yeah, he's a wild dog.
This is it. Like, he's. Like, that he had no shred of humanity. I'm like, okay, he's going to be the one that's going to. Like, I knew. That's where I figured out. I'm like, he's going to. Like, when he killed the Emperor, I had no surprise. The denying slight surprised me.
Mm-hmm. Scott, what do you think?
I've already said that I think he's the best. I was very young once again when I played this game. I played it right when it came out, so I had no idea. I was taken for a ride. I really thought that the floating continent was the end of the game. I'm sure a lot of other people did too. Yeah. And when he killed the Emperor and then he rearranged the statues, that's when it all hit me. Oh my gosh, it's going to be him. No, I hate him so much. Oh, man. Yeah.
Next, you're going to fight the Emperor.
Zach?
I have to agree. Best villain. And yeah, I'm with Scott. Like, I was a kid, so I had no earthly clue what was going to happen. But for that statue moment, and for him to just betray everyone and everything so completely, and open up this new, you know, apocalypse, in the world, I mean, it was this guy all along, this little piece, like this nothing, and he's our enemy. Like I was shocked by it. Like, I mean, I knew he was bad, like poisoning sign and all that, but for him to end up being the big baddie was definitely a surprise for me.
Jeremy, there's this specific moment we're talking about where they've discovered the origin of magic is these three goddess statues. And, you know, that moment is so interesting because it's Kefka, like, doesn't have a plan. Like, the Emperor tries to kill him, and he just happens to be standing within the field of the magic. Like, he's just literally standing in the right spot. And so, like, magic will not affect him. So then he takes advantage of it and kills the Emperor and wrecks the world, which is so interesting to me because it's kind of dumb luck. It's like this kind of, like, goes back to Kefka as just this force of kind of chaos and dumb luck, really, you know?
He was going to get betrayed.
Yeah. Jeremy, so there you go. Nobody thinks it's Sephiroth, man.
Oh, yeah, well, that's not surprising.
You know what, Jeremy? I will take the bat for Final Fantasy VII, because while I do think Kefka is a really well-developed and good villain, I think Sephiroth is a great personal villain for Cloud. And, I mean, that game's narrative is focused on Cloud. It's not really an ensemble as much as Six is. So I think, in that respect, Sephiroth does really succeed as a personal force for Cloud.
But the mystery of him is really cool.
Yeah, Sephiroth.
The mystery of Sephiroth all through the beginning of this, like, thing, this, you never, the, it's a ton of buildup for you actually deal with. I'll give that a lot of credit.
And they do the most fake out with Sephiroth, I think, than they do with any other villain.
Fair.
I also say Sin is a great villain, but that's a discussion for another time. So.
Yeah.
My dad is Sin.
What the fuck is going on? The first time you start singing that, Scott, like that's
lovely rendition.
So I do feel like the bad guys are also like, I feel like a weird stab at gay people, because they're always dressed like just flaming queens. Like they are absolutely without a doubt fanny bandits.
I don't know.
Like,
I think it gives gay people some agency in this.
They're
world.
Just like, it's just really it's truth be told that we are going to eventually destroy you all. Like,
I know, but it's
like,
going to be a lot of
nine,
fun.
I can't remember what his name was. Who was dressed
Kuja.
Who's dressed in like? He's dressed in like slutty spring break girl swimsuits. Like he's just, yeah. Like
it's the
really,
under.
Like, he is dressed like an anime whore, and it's just it's
the underpinning of why they want to take over the world and have power, is so that they can dictate what fashion is.
Right, that everyone can dress up that's up their ass and, you know, crunching their balls. Apparently.
Yeah. Well, that some people like that.
It is, apparently. I'm wearing that right now. That's what I came here.
Anything else you want to say about Kefka, guys? Because we need to move on if we're all good.
Yeah.
His laugh is
pretty great.
It's phenomenal. The tower at the end.
It's even built into the final song, which I think is amazing.
That's true, yeah. Okay, there you go. Great transition. We do need to talk about the music. I want to start this section off with this question. Is this Nobuo Uematsu's best work in video games? Silence.
I don't know the list of all the ones he's worked on.
I have a wonderful opinion on this, but I'll go ahead if
go ahead. What's your wonderful opinion?
Yeah,
so oh gosh, it's so hard for me to say if this is his best or not. I think that this score has one of the best musical things that has ever happened in any video game. But wow. I think that there is a game of his that as a whole is better, as a whole, top to bottom. But it's so hard for me to pick because the opera scene, the music in the opera scene, it's an opera. It's a legit opera. And even on 16-bit, it's just fantastic. There are movements. The battle music when you fight Ultros is part of the opera. You have to learn the aria. Celeste has to learn the aria. You have to learn the blocking. And me being a kid who loved drama and theater anyway, this was the thing that you saved your game for, to go through the opera scene. That being said, I know I might be in the minority, but I think top to bottom, the score of Final Fantasy VIII is actually his best. And it may also have to do with that was one of the first ones that they had top to bottom symphonically recorded. Like top to bottom, it was an actual orchestra playing. And that may have pushed me a little bit, but Final Fantasy VI does have the best music moment of any role-playing game.
I would like to just jump on that real quick, Scott, and say that not only do you have the opera scene, but Zach mentioned the final battle with Kefka, and as you were fighting the various parts of Kefka, you have this really long piece of music that transitions as you move your way up the tower, the demonic tower that you're fighting, that the music changes, which is really, really cool. And then you have the 12-minute ending medley, character theme medley that's so freaking awesome
perfect.
That he wrote.
It's perfect.
So it's perfect. Good.
Tough it's call.
Perfect. It's perfect.
Zach, bring some sanity to us. Is this his best score?
I have to say that it is. I mean, maybe it's not the most interesting thing to say right now, but I mean, it's just every character has their own theme. And you spend enough time away from that theme to forget it so that each time when you come back to it, it's like this nice little surprise, like, oh yeah, Setzer's theme, like we're gonna go gambling now. We're gonna fly around in the airship and have adventures. Oh yeah, it's science theme. My family's dead, you know?
well Jesus.
Well, I mean, but it's dead there, you know. Music. It's all there in the music and it and to circle all the way back around. It helps create that tone, which was so important to me as a kid, like the idea of feeling my way through this story and the music. Just, I mean, he's working with this limited palette, you know, it's 16-bit, you know, it's MIDI files, but he manages to do so much with it and to make this limited palette into something that measures up with other video game music that came later that had full, you know, audio files to work with. It's pretty remarkable for me.
Gavin, I see you look like you have opinions over there.
Because I would have said yes until I looked up his list of works. And because my order of favorite video game music of all time, this is second.
Oh, wait, what's number one? What's
to Chrono Trigger. Mm-hmm. And I just found, I did not know he did Chrono Trigger. So this is now my second.
He did part of Chrono Trigger.
He didn't do most of Chrono Trigger.
Oh really? He got listed for credit with it.
Yeah, he is credited.
If he composed it, then yes, this is his best. Just because in my list of best games, I think that is by and far the best music that has ever been created for a game. And then this was my second one. Okay. So I think the embodiment of the theme for every character embodies their character immaculately. It absolutely, like every single person's theme just absolutely shapes mm-hmm. who they are instantaneously and their entire. So like it was very smart composing, like absolutely.
John, what do you think?
I mean, yeah, it's my favorite video game music of all time. Probably the only game that I can think of that anywhere comes close in terms of music is Braid, the platformer.
Oh
yeah. Yeah.
I still have to play that.
It's really absolutely gorgeous music.
Really good music.
But I mean, you have to give it, yeah, like Zach was saying, it was 16-bit, it was MIDI files. The fact that he was able to get such a lush palette of sound out of that technology is fascinating.
Well, I have to do this follow-up question, of course. What is your favorite track from this soundtrack? Or if you had to go to somebody and say, listen to this song, which one would you say? I'm going to choose something that probably won't get said, but I really love Science Theme. I think it's one of the best pieces from this. Mm-hmm. You know, ignoring the opera. It's so haunting and beautiful and noble. It's just such a great scene, a great song. So that would be my pick.
Can I jump in?
Oh, yes, go ahead, Jeremy.
I actually... having never played Final Fantasy III/6, I had known and loved Terra's theme for ever since I started playing Final Fantasy. Like, and I started. I really like video game music as a whole, so I've always Googled stuff, found stuff, and I've come across Terra's theme a while back, and it just stands out as such a great song. I haven't heard a lot of the other songs, but I listen to Terra's theme regularly. It's really, really good.
I think also, real quick, this soundtrack was sold in the U.S. Mm-hmm. I imported it from Japan because I assumed you could only import video game music. But I think back in the 90s, this was one of the first soundtracks actually sold. I don't know how well it sold at the time. Probably not as well as it did in Japan. But I imported this. I imported Secret of Mana, of course, Final Fantasy mm-hmm. IV, and Chrono Trigger.
They made piano soundtracks, too. And like,
oh, yeah.
They've made piano ones that are, very well done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have a horrible story about this real quick. I think I may have said this on another podcast. I competed in the 1990 Nintendo World Championships.
Oh, yeah, we're familiar.
And I had
were
one
you
of
in the movie The Wizard?
I wasn't. But I had one of the game cartridges from that, and they're worth thousands of dollars. I had two of them. I lost one of them, and the other one I traded for a copy of the Final Fantasy VI soundtrack.
Oh.
Worth it.
But at the time, it was worth it because you couldn't, there was no internet. You couldn't hear this music other than, I remember I would like clean my room. I would turn on the video game. I would have the overworld theme of Terra playing, and I would just clean my room while like the overworld theme was just playing. Like, that's what I would do.
Yeah.
That's a great day.
To me, my favorite that's not the opera, I'll throw in something. I always mention how Umatsu does his cave music so well. And the South Figaro cave music is just a beautiful, beautiful piece. Da da da. You know, that with the boop up boop, boop up boop up boop, boop up boop. It kind of sounds like the stuff echoing off the cave wall. Oh, it's so awesome.
Zach, did you answer?
Not yet. I've got actually two tracks that I really love, and so far nobody said them, so I feel okay about it. I think the first is the Edgar and Savin like castle theme, because to me it's a lot like Greensleeves, where it's this whole suggestive like Renaissance music for this castle, like this real big noble swell of music in the first half of the game. And then the second track that I really really love. I think it's called The Last Dungeon, and it's the track that starts playing right when you get to the top of Kefka's Tower, and you've got your three different parties that mm-hmm. have to start in different spots, and it's this big like introduction to the final moments of the game, right?
It's
like
very okay, industrial.
Yeah, it's this big industrial track, and it's real. It's got some beeps and boops and buzzes to it, and it sets you off down the final path. And I always got super excited when that track would start playing. I think that was my favorite one.
Can we give props to how difficult that last dungeon is? Like, that is a really good last dungeon that you have to navigate with three different parties helping each other out to get further mm-hmm. into it.
And make sure you have enough characters that you're not stuck with the Sasquatch.
Tomorrow.
Oh, poor Morrow.
Can I say, I forgot that Celeste's theme as well, obviously that's part of the opera, but her actual theme that starts off with the, you know, it has the running theme in the piano, the first time you hear that is when she's like crying outside, and like right when she starts getting emotional and crying, that's when that theme starts, and it kind of feels like emotion welling up, and then when the main theme comes in, it's like a release. It's just so perfect. It's so great. Maybe this is my favorite soundtrack. I can't, you know, if I start listening to my favorites of Final Fantasy VIII, I mean, because that's just fully orchestrated and beautiful and perfect as well. If you guys haven't heard that, or you don't have an appreciation for the Libra Fatale and all the stuff that symphonic Final Fantasy VIII, you should listen to it because it's unbelievably beautiful. I know Chris will agree with me, but this soundtrack is perfect. It's so good.
For me, the Opera House, of course, is in its own category. It's my favorite video game moment. So, I think it's my favorite overworld theme.
Which one? The World of Balance or the World of Ruin?
The World of Balance. Okay. It's a great, great...
It's very epic.
Yeah, it captures the scope and the size of the mission and what you have to do in a really beautiful way. I think ultimately I love Setzer's theme a lot because it also kind of captures that epicness and adventurousness. But I think my favorite, the more I think about it, is... Oh, I love the Zozo music.
That's mine. That's it. I love it.
I just love everything about Zozo. But Realm's theme, I always come back to just because it sounds so different than anything else and it's such this like... Everything in the game I feel is so, it's either epic or scary or weird or melancholy or wistful, and hers is this pure, innocent hope that you don't really get in a lot of the other music, which I think makes it stand out so much.
For character theme, by far, Realm. I actually think she has one of the best ones of any game ever. One of them. And then, I love the Zozo music a lot, and I actually love the weird, like, the bar casino, like, the da-da-da-da. I just think it captures it really, really just very well. Like there are girls dancing on tables in this music. Like, it absolutely has that very, very good sound to it. I think those are my favorite.
Speaking of bar music, on this recent playthrough, when you get to the Opera House, like, the Opera House lobby... music kind of sounds like this French farce, just like the do 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 do. It's so great. It's so much fun. Such a good soundtrack. You all had great answers. Great job, guys.
I also like. I will say, even clever for the game that they had. That in the Opera House, when you go up into the upper rafters, the music gets dimmer, which I just think is incredibly clever for a game.
So awesome.
Time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So awesome. This game is so great. It really it's just ridiculous. We're talking about a game in 1994.
Can you imagine being someone who's never played it? How terrible you must feel.
Jeremy.
That's a great segue into one of the last questions that I have for you guys is how do people play this nowadays?
I don't know if you guys did this. Probably not, because I'm just one of those weird completionist kids, but I made a chart for the Colosseum, and I had a chart of every single item and what you would get and, you know, like what you would win and then what that item can turn into. And like, I did the whole chains on how to get the experience egg and what you needed to do to get the Illumina and all this stuff. I had books. I had pages and pages of it. Crazy. Good. Anybody else do that? No?
I made one of those for the belt.
You're how those things exist on the internet that you could look up.
I bought the strategy guide.
Oh, there you go. I didn't have that. Also, the Vanish Doom trick. I actually figured that out before it was common knowledge. Did anybody else do that?
Yeah, but I didn't like it.
You figured that out, but you couldn't win the 1990 World Championships for Nintendo.
What kind of wizard are you?
Tetris was the final game. Come on, Tetris. And the kid who won, Thor Ackerlin, he memorized the game.
His
name was Thor Ackerlin.
That's not a real person.
I'm not making
He sounds
this
like a superhero who sells cars.
Yeah, that's a fake human.
He was a fake
from
human.
From another world where science and magic are the same. He's born.
Yeah, you know his real name is like Steve Baker.
Maybe. But he figured out that when you finished Mario, the first of the three games, whatever time you had left gave you one of 16 different patterns in Tetris. And he memorized all 16 of them and had a perfect score and won the tournament.
But to bring it back to Final Fantasy, you discovered the Vanish Doom trick.
I did, because I would use Vanish on Shadow, and he was so powerful, and they kept missing. But it's like, but you're really weak to magic. And I was like, oh, that Doom spell never works. I wonder, can I vanish the enemy? And then I was like, wait, can I vanish bosses? And it's like, yes, you can. Wait,
I think I did it on an invisible character, a bad, because one of the bad guys somewhere that they're invisible.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I did it. It's in the tower, the Kefka, yes. The magic tower. I did it on accident, I think, and I was like, wait a minute.
You know, the Vanish Doom is really nice for grinding, because you can really, the only thing I would use it for now is for grinding, because you can go in the world of Ruin, you can go to the dinosaur island,
yeah.
And you can go there really early, and you can vanish a Tyrannosaurus Rex, and it's a really quick way to build up all those characters that you don't use, because that would take so much time, because you've got to have, you know, a good 12 characters to navigate.
Minus
the
Sasquatch.
I spent a lot exactly. of time on the dinosaur island.
Jeremy, I don't think that even remotely answered your question. What was your question?
I was wondering, how would you introduce someone to this game now? Its original was on Super Nintendo, and they had a GBA version of it, and yeah. I think there's an iOS Android app for it. But like,
that's
what
correct.
What would you guys recommend for someone that hasn't played before?
Well, real quick, there is no DS remake of this, unfortunately, which I would like to see a DS
yeah.
remake with,
oh, yeah.
with full voice acting. They did a remake for Final Fantasy IV, which was really cool on the DS, and
the
voice actors was really fun. So I would love to see them do that with this. You can get
yeah.
this on Virtual Console for the Wii. The original cartridge for the Super Nintendo is actually a collector's item, so it's batshit crazy expensive.
Okay, what if I don't have a Wii?
You can get an
yeah,
emulator.
Would you
iPhone. Your iPhone or emulator, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Emulator for me is the best. Cause
emulators for Super Nintendo are the best games.
Yeah.
Yeah. The iPhone version, if you have an iPhone 6 Plus, looks gorgeous. But I purposely have not gotten it because I'm waiting. I haven't played the game since the GBA, and I am waiting patiently for a remake.
They have no intention of doing it.
Yeah, they'll probably never do it.
From what I heard.
They're going to do it.
Which is so tragic.
Scott is willing it to happen.
Why would they do 4 and not do 6? It's not like 7. 7 is the one that they're like, we're definitely not going to do. They did 4. Why wouldn't they do 6?
I don't know
why
they haven't gone through 4, 5, and 6. Like, why yeah. they haven't just done the whole...
That's a great question for Square Enix.
Dear Square.
So we slowly need to wrap this up. I don't want to do final thoughts, because we've talked a lot, and we freaking love this game. Here's the final question I want to pose to everyone. What is your favorite moment in this game? And I'll go first, just to give everybody time. One of my favorite moments in this game, you touched on my second favorite one, actually, Gavin, which was the tomb
mm-hmm.
with Setzer, which... That's so
sad.
That moment is so beautiful and such a great development for that character. But actually, one of my favorite moments is with Cyan. When you find him in the world of Ruin... later in the game, he is he's no longer fighting. He's writing letters to this woman whose boyfriend had died, and he's posing as her boyfriend to give her hope. And that really just like jumped out at me as a, you know, 13-year-old. I was like, oh wow, like that's what he's chosen to do, is to give this one person hope. And of course, you get him back in your party, and he decides it's probably a little better to tell the truth, so he writes her a letter, and his final letter to her, I think you can read it, and he says something along the lines of, you know, I'm so sorry I did this. You are strong enough now to have hope for yourself. Go find hope in this world of ours. And it was just such a cool moment for that character. I mean, his character, a lot of the characters in the second half of the game are looking for hope, but I feel he's been looking for hope the whole game since he lost his family, and it was just a cool moment for his character, so that would be mine.
I mean, I've already said the Opera House is in its own category, so we don't need to talk about that. It's amazing, it's beautiful. I really love the entire Phantom Train sequence.
Yes.
Especially the very
end.
Best
music, too. One of
Music-wise, it's great. And Yeah, like the goodbye to his family as the train goes away.
Dark. This is a dark game.
I mean, it's crushing and it's horrible, but it's also beautiful in a way, you know? So that would be definitely one of mine.
Yeah.
As I said before, I think the Forgotten Tomb is a beautiful part of the game. I think another very interesting part is where you find all the characters, like finding Terra in a village where the only survivors were the children because they were off to the side. So everyone else in the city died, and she's taking care of these kids with these other two,
teenagers,
which are presumably also young.
Yeah.
And yeah. And they all refer to her as mother, which is actually giving her the sense of family she never had. Again, this is a really dark ass
game. Totally forgot.
This is like a really dark ass game. Really think about it. You're like, great, dear teenager, like you know, junior high school level kids, please be depressed now. Yeah, I think that is also just a very, it's very, very fascinating part of the game.
I think for me, I mean, every moment you've listed and just so many other moments, but maybe a personal one that I sort of created for myself was when you first get the cursed ring. I don't know if you guys remember the cursed ring.
Yeah.
There's a way to convert it, right? You can convert it to the Paladin ring, but you got to equip it for 256 shield. Battles.
Cursed shield.
Cursed shield, excuse me. So I did it, you know, I equipped the cursed shield and I went off to the Dinosaur Island and, for 256 battles, I had this thing equipped until I was just so sick of all of the bad effects and then grinding it out for that long. And then when it finally converted, it was such a great item and such a cool thing to have accomplished for myself that, I don't know, I felt great about it. I was like, that's a tough thing to get and you have to work at it. And then I finally got it. And then like a couple hours later, the sketch bug happened. So I got like 70, Paladin shields.
Everybody gets a Paladin shield. Yay.
Well, that's, okay. Well, then I didn't have to. Huh.
How long did it take to do 256 battles? Do you remember?
I don't even remember. It took me days. It took me more than one session, you know, saving, like grinding out 60, 70 battles, saving, leaving, coming back, grinding out 60 or 70 battles.
Oh, man.
Yeah, and it just took forever. And I was, 150 battles in, I was like, I don't care anymore. I don't even care. But still kept, I even gave it to Saban. I gave it to my tank and still kept going and still kept going. And then finally it worked out. It was really cool.
Scott, favorite moment?
So many of them have already been said. I'm going to talk about one of my other favorite moments. My favorite moment in the game is the opera scene. We know that. We've already discussed how it's great. It's its own game. It's the best thing ever. Anyway, one of the coolest moments in the game is when you make a truce with the Empire. Do you guys remember that in the first half?
Yes.
Of the game? When like the Empire like surrenders and like you have these questions you have to answer, and depending on how well you answer them, they'll pull their troops out of Figaro and they'll give you the Genji glove, or they'll give you but just that's so cool that they're surrendering and you're like discussing the terms of surrender, and the whole time it was a trap. Oh, so awesome.
Yeah, that part I always tried to like get the best score that I could out of that to get all the really cool things. And it took me a long time to figure out.
Like we had to go through and talk to all of them. Yeah.
Yeah. And certain troopers would
fight
you.
It's weird because you have to be a little forgiving, but you have to be stern about certain things.
And you have to bust the one on the toilet.
Yeah, right. You do. You do. Yeah.
I think you can make everyone poop. I love that. That was one of the things that I thought was hilarious.
Oh,
was the, and they would all like do that little, they would do the, when they were weak. That's with the pixel.
Oh.
When they were pooping, they would have that weak pose, and you're like, well, that's how everyone in this game looks when they poop.
Really, that's what we're gonna go out on?
Yep. Everybody poops, even in Final Fantasy.
Jeremy, have we done it? Are you gonna try Final Fantasy VI? You gonna try and go back sometime?
It's on my list. It's very high on my list of games that I just didn't get to as a kid and always wanted to play. And, you know, for me, I come at it from the same point of a lot of people that just didn't play some 8-bit versions or 16-bit versions of games. I think the best case scenario would have been playing them as a kid. But I'm excited to experience it as an adult and see if it still holds up.
I would say it holds up, I think.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I agree.
I now want to go home.
Well, that's all from your guys' perspective, having played it as a kid.
That is
like,
true.
It's different. It's different having nothing to reminisce of and going back to old graphics.
I played Earthbound as an adult about a year and a half ago. And it was so fun. Like I got my hand because I'd never played it, and it became available for a Wii U.
It's on
for a virtual console, and I was like, I have never played this, and it was so fun.
Yeah, I guess. If you're good with retro graphics, then yeah, it totally holds up. I mean, there are new retro games being made today, like Shovel Knight is a great example. That game looks like it was made in 1988, but it's so freaking like great, you know. So I think you're in for a joy, Jeremy. I really do. So I hope you'll give it a chance. I am curious, what are three like games on this list that you're saying that you've got?
Things that you'll get mad at me about.
Yeah.
Or that everybody will get mad at me about. Number one, other than Final Fantasy VI, is Chrono Trigger.
What?
No.
Oh, come on.
Here we go.
You need to go leave right now.
Yes. Yeah, it's one of the other games that I just, like, I played, I don't know, a 12th, a 10th, a, like, minuscule portion, and then just never continued on with it.
That one they did re-release on 3DS.
On the DS, yes.
I did. I saw that. I saw that. It's now going to be a little side mission for me to find someone that has that game and I can borrow it from him.
Well, I just found my Outcast. Then
yep. It's going to function mostly the same as this. I don't know it. I want to play it.
What's one other game on that list, Jeremy?
Final Fantasy IV.
Okay.
Two, four. Yeah.
Well, I hope you will give... I don't know which of those three to tell you to play first, but... Since we're talking about Final Fantasy VI right now, I'm going to say go play VI first. So, we slowly have to wrap this up. Does anybody have anything that they wish to plug at this time? Other shows that they're working on? Other podcasts? Now is the time.
I'll start. I just started working on a podcast of my own. I've got just the one episode out right now, but I would recommend it because I'm in it. But it's called The Evening Pulsar, and it's a podcast that's like a smooth jazz podcast that takes place on a space station. So give it a whirl. It's about a sitcom episode's worth of time. So even if you don't like it, it really hasn't impacted your day too much.
Nice, sir.
I would just like to plug my band, Bourbon and Bliss. Check us out, bourbonandbliss.com. We have an album we released last August, doing well. Give us a listen.
I started a company that is focused on giving tours of Rome in Italy. So it's called Vicolo Tours, Vicolo Tours.com. If you or anybody else that you know wants to go to Italy, you go to the site, sign up, and I'm really excited about it. It's going to be great.
Never saw that coming.
None of us saw that coming.
Yeah, I've been focused on some really interesting stuff that has nothing to do with nerd stuff lately.
That's all right. Cool.
I'm in a show right now called 1979 with my group Pink Pony. It's me and my fiance Andy. You can check us out at pinkpony.com, which is www.pinkuepony.com. And I'm currently working on a opera that I've written about a Sasquatch that no one likes, called Umaro. The Sun Will Come Out, Umaro.
Oh, wonderful. That's delightful.
Does it better be true, or I'm going to kill you?
Sorry, I had that pun like an hour ago, and I've been trying to shoot it in some way.
It's beautiful. There it is. John. There it is.
That's brilliant. Gavin?
I guess I am my comedy partner, who I refer to as my improv wife, is may or may not be the girlfriend of the host of this show. They never announce it. You never know. Melissa McNamara, she and I are in a group called Chairs, and you can check us out. We have a Facebook page. We'll be playing in the Chicago Improv Festival. We play in a number of festivals. We have a YouTube page.
When is the Improv Festival?
It is in the end of April.
Okay.
Though we have not been given our official show date yet, but if you like our page on Facebook, we will announce it there. We do have a show this coming Friday if you're in Chicago. at Mind Art Core. It's our birthday show because our birthdays are 6 days apart. And you can come out and it's BYOB, BYO snacks, hugs required. We'll probably be drunk. And yeah.
You can find me. I was just recently on my friend Mark Soloff's Blastro podcast. We were actually doing the science of video games, and that episode was just recently released. So I would highly recommend going to check out Blastro podcast. We have a whole bunch of new topics coming out in the next few months. New video games that we'll be discussing, comic books and whatnot. So please stay tuned to the Nerd Outcast podcast. And of course, if you always have questions, concerns, or topic suggestions, you can email them to nerdoutcastpodcast@gmail.com. Gentlemen, thank you so much for coming out and talking about this really great game that I feel we should all go home and play right now.
Yes, no joke. Thanks for having us.
That's brilliant. I have been your host, Chris Bashan, and joining me to talk about Final Fantasy VI have been
John Luce,
Gavin Dunellen,
Zach Munn,
T. Scott Ross,
Jeremy Connie.
Thank you for listening.